Good afternoon. My name is Jeremy Rosenblum, and as a partner here at Bell Inspire and a board member of the Middle East Forum, it's my pleasure to welcome you to this event. Before introducing our speaker, Alon Berman, I'd like to take a moment to talk just a little bit about the forum's important work and to encourage those of you who are not participating currently to join in its efforts. I'll take out of order a remark I was going to make. Please, if everybody could turn off their cell phones and beepers, that would be appreciated. Under the direction of Daniel Pipes, who I personally regard as a true American hero, the Middle East Forum works to define and promote American interests in the Middle East. Is consistently displayed an unparalleled grasp of key issues, whether that involves exposing the threat posed by radical Islam, working for Palestinian acceptance of Israel, or critiquing the extremist orthodoxy that prevails in Middle East studies on North American college campuses. The Middle East Forum is really in the forefront. Through research, publishing, media work, and public education, including today's program, the forum energizes public debate by addressing a range of issues and by offering fresh and sound perspectives on policy. If you've not done so already, I'd like to encourage you to add your name to the forum's email list, which is here, or to go directly to the forum's website, which is www.meforum.org. Sign up there and read about the forum's work. Now, as you know, our speaker is Alon Berman. He's the Vice President for Policy at the American Foreign Policy Council in Washington, D.C. He's a true expert on security issues in the Middle East, Central Asia, and Russia. He has consulted for the CIA and the Pentagon and is a frequent guest on radio and television. His writings have appeared on a widespread basis in the National Interest, the International Herald Tribune, the Financial Times, and in our organization's own Middle East Quarterly. He's an adjunct professor at the National Defense University and editor of the Journal of International Security Affairs. Today, Alon will discuss his new book, Tehran Rising, in which he analyzes the threat posed by Iran in the Middle East, and for that matter, throughout the world. This includes the regime's active development of nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction, as well as its status as the single largest exporter of terrorism worldwide. I've read Tehran Rising, and I can personally testify that it presents a chilling, readable, and meticulously documented analysis of the problem and proposes policy strategies to address it. Signed copies of Tehran Rising will be available for purchase after today's program. And so, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Alon Berman to the podium.
Thank you very much, and after that introduction, I think I have to start by saying that I'm here as the Vice President for Policy of the American Foreign Policy Council. I don't represent the CIA, I don't represent the Pentagon. I would like them to adopt some of my ideas, certainly, but I'm here, this is what you get. I wanted to thank the Middle East Forum again for hosting me. I think this is a very important time to talk about this sort of issue, and I'm very glad that there's this kind of interest, this kind of turnout for an event like this. The other thing I think I would say is that I'm not an Iran expert, per se. I don't speak Farsi. I haven't spent time in country. What I am is, I come to the Middle East by way of the Soviet Union. I'm a Sovietologist by training, Russian by first language. I spend a lot of time day-to-day, certainly in the last 4 years or so, tracking security trends in the greater Middle East and Central Asia, the Caucasus and the Caspian. And over the last 4 years, the pattern has really been unmistakable. Everywhere you look, whether it's Azerbaijan or Turkey or in the Persian Gulf among the Gulf Cooperation Council states, Iran is making new political, diplomatic, economic, even military entrees into countries that are historically hostile to it or into regions that historically have not seen its influence in any measurable manner. So the aggregate outcome that I saw was precisely what my book is entitled, which is, you know, Tehran is rising. It's rising fairly rapidly, and it poses a challenge to the United States. So, and I tend to think that that challenge is much broader than the nuclear program. And I'll explain why in a second. But the nuclear program, since it tends to dominate the headlines, that's a good place to start. So, what do we know? All the signs suggest that Iran is moving very aggressively towards a nuclear capability that could be weaponized, meaning they might not necessarily be building nuclear warheads, but they at least want a breakout capability so they can have highly enriched uranium, which they can convert into weapons-usable material and very quickly have an offensive nuclear arsenal that they can mount on their delivery systems. They have all the makings of an enormous national nuclear endeavor. They have dozens of hardened sites, hidden sites, sites that we know about but we can't get access to. They're working both on plutonium conversion and on uranium enrichment, the two ways you can get a bomb. And they have followed, I think most tellingly, this pattern of obfuscation towards the International Atomic Energy Agency, where IAEA inspectors are not allowed to see certain sites. Other sites they're allowed to see, but they've been quote-unquote sanitized, as one official told me, where it's quite clear that equipment has been removed from there, that they've been bleached and scrubbed. So if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, I would tend to suspect that it's a duck or some sort of fowl. So it looks to me for all the world like Iran is pursuing a fairly aggressive program intended at its endpoint to have a nuclear capability and a nuclear capability that it can wield as a foreign policy tool. Now, Iran's nuclear program actually predates the current regime. It started in the late 60s and early 70s under the Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. We didn't worry about that much, even though the Shah's nuclear endeavor was probably larger than the type of activity that we're seeing now in Iran. And we didn't worry about it because for all of his faults, and there were many, the Shah was viewed correctly as being reasonably accountable and pro-Western. The current regime is not, and so this is the crux, I think, of the problem. The nuclear activity, though, in Iran, it's been going on for a long time. They revived it shortly after the 79 revolution, with a distinctly military purpose, by the way. But it's really accelerated dramatically over the last 3 years or so. And it's done so, I think, probably because the Iranians see a very clear choice ahead. When the president labeled Iraq, along with Iran and North Korea, as members of an axis of evil, he, for the good or for bad, created this sort of elite category. Now, two and a half years on, one of those regimes, which turns out didn't have much by way of weapons of mass destruction, is gone. The other one has fared a lot better. It's fared a lot better because in October of 2002, the North Koreans conducted an unexpected nuclear breakout. They announced to nuclear negotiators, we have a bomb and you're going to have to live with it. And that has succeeded in, for lack of a better term, preempting preemption. We really don't have much by way of strategy with regard to the North Korean nuclear crisis. And I think that that says a lot to the Iranians. If you're an Iranian, and a fairly nationalist Iranian, you want to be a North Korea. You don't want to be an Iraq. You want to be around. You see nuclear capability as an element of regime stability, no matter what they say publicly in the press. Point being, the Iranian regime has learned to love the bomb. And we should expect this to be seen in Iran not as a bargaining chip for negotiations with Europe, but as an element of regime stability. In fact, I think you could make a pretty credible case that the Iranians think that if they give up their nuclear development and conduct a lasting nuclear freeze, it will make the idea of U.S. military action against them more likely, not less likely. So at least that's what they think. So that said, I think it's useful to look at sort of the broader picture and take a bird's eye view. The nuclear program is only a part of the larger challenge that Iran poses to the U.S. And in fact, I tend to think it's somewhat small compared to the other ones. Obviously, we should talk about support for terrorism. State Department's been tracking terrorist trends for about two decades now. And every year when it publishes its report, no matter what it's called, because we've changed the name, Iran has ranked at the top of the list as the world's premier state sponsor of terror. And frankly, not much has changed since September 11th. In fact, if you take the president at his word and countries need to choose whether they're with us or with the terrorists, it's quite clear that Iran's made the choice to be with the terrorists. They've spent a lot of time over the last couple of years expanding Hezbollah's reach. The Shiite militia in Lebanon has something in the neighborhood of 12,000 artillery and short-range rockets, many of them of Iranian manufacture, which they can wield as a strategic tool against the Israelis. It's also helping Hezbollah to put down roots in new regions, for example, in Africa. There's a lot of evidence that Hezbollah has begun a really landmark sort of expansion of the organization. And the end result is that a lot of U.S. officials say that the Hezbollah's capabilities now actually equal or exceed those of al-Qaeda. We just don't hear a lot about them. You also see the sort of tactical cooperation that is very troubling between Iran and al-Qaeda. The federal government, through wiretaps and all sorts of other intelligence gathering methods, discovered that between the middle of 2002 and the middle of 2003, fully 10% of communications between al-Qaeda operatives and leadership came into and went out of Iran. So it's quite clear that there's at least a part of a logistical hub that's operating in Iran. And I find it very hard to believe that it's operating in Iran without the knowledge of at least some of the authorities there. Now, traditionally, we tend not to think that this sort of thing is totally counterintuitive. For a long time, and still in some quarters today, we've thought that the idea of a Sunni group and a Shiite regime cooperating is kind of counterintuitive. It is, and it isn't. It is because they do have differences, theological differences, in terms of interpretation of Islam. But as a tactical matter, as a practical matter, Iran and al-Qaeda can make common cause. And I think we're seeing this in action. Al-Qaeda has been particularly active through the good graces of individuals like Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who's a Jordanian-born terrorist. His Ansar al-Islam has migrated from northern Iraq since Operation Iraqi Freedom to the Kurdish regions of Iran, where they're actually doing a lot of basing and logistics for the type of operations for the insurgency that are going on now. Zarqawi was given safe haven in Iran during one of the three or four major sweeps of the coalition did of northern Iraq. So it's quite clear that, at least on a tactical level, there's a lot of aid and comfort happening. I think the most important thing is meddling in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And here, let me just throw out an example. In early 2005, the Israeli Internal Security Service, the Shin Bet, released a report in which it said that Hezbollah, and through Hezbollah, Iran, directed over 50 separate Palestinian terror cells in 2004. The report was significant because the report stressed that is a sevenfold increase over 2002 numbers. So the trend here is clear. There is a political vacuum that's taking place in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and Hezbollah is filling it, and through Hezbollah, Iran is filling it. I think that's one aspect of the threat that we don't focus on enough. Another is what they're doing in the Persian Gulf. In comparative terms, post Saddam Hussein, Iran is the region's dominant military power, and they're shoring up this position through substantial investments in military technology, courtesy of China, courtesy of Russia, North Korea, and they're also altering the regional balance of power by hammering out bilateral security pacts with the Saudis, with the Kuwaitis, with the Omanis over the last 3 or 4 years. So, in the aggregate, I think the trend here is that the balance of power in the Persian Gulf is shifting, and unfortunately, it's shifting away from the United States and the coalition towards another area entirely, towards a dominant Iran. Finally, we know a lot about Iranian meddling in the insurgency in Iraq, Iranian support for the insurgency. I think it's always best to let officials talk for themselves. So in my book, I include this quote from an official who was then the director of Iran. Iran's clerical army, the Pasdaran. And he said that what they're doing in Iraq makes a lot of sense because, quote, if American strategy fails heavily in Iraq, it will undoubtedly stop. Otherwise, it may extend to neighboring countries. So Iran sees instability in Iraq as an insurance policy to prevent democratization in their own country. And that is, I think, a very important element to consider, because right now in Iraq we're seeing all sorts of transitions to at least something approaching mature nation statehood, embodying a constitution, embodying various political factions, bickering, often bitterly, but bickering. The Iranians see this as a threat, and so the Iranian interference in Iraq is going to increase, it's not going to decrease. And then in the region that nobody talks about, because most people can't find it on the map, is Central Asia and the Caucasus, cumulatively the post-Soviet space. Iran is very active there, and it's very counterintuitive that they're active there, because for the last decade or so, they've had this marriage of convenience with the Russians, where they actually steer clear of meddling in the Caucasus, in the Caspian, in return for conventional military technology and later nuclear know-how. That's changing a little bit, and it's changing because Iran is rapidly becoming aware of the fact that the investment of American forces in the region in support of coalition operations in Afghanistan and Operation Iraqi Freedom is a threat to their expansion of influence in their backyard, and so they're actually stepping up their activism. They're co-opting countries that could potentially be useful to the United States. In mid-May, the Iranian government and the Azeri government signed a memorandum of understanding that codified a bilateral security promise that neither would host troops that are hostile to the other country. So it's quite clear they didn't name us by name, but it's quite clear that they're worried about the U.S. basing in Azerbaijan. They're also expanding their profile in the Caspian Sea, building up their naval flotilla there. They've actually redirected a lot of their resources north. And that's significant because the Caspian is rapidly emerging as a fairly substantial energy hub. And, you know, with gas prices what they are today, having regions co-opted by one player is not in the interest of the energy market. This gets us to what should we do about it? That is the multi-tier threat. And the U.S., unfortunately, so far has only been responding to one aspect of it. Since February, the administration has been pursuing nuclear negotiations by way of the European Union, the EU3, with Iran. We all know that those negotiations have now fizzled out. They've hit a dead end. But even if they didn't, or even if they get restarted, they're not going to work. And they're not going to work for a number of reasons. First of all, the president talked about the fact that the U.S. cannot tolerate a nuclear Iran, whereas officials in at least some corners of Europe have implicitly endorsed some level of Iranian capability. They say that it's for civilian energy production purposes, but they are okay with the current regime in Iran having some level of nuclear capability, and the administration is not. So it seems to me that we have a fairly substantial incompatibility of goals with our negotiating partners on the same side of the table. The second is that the Europeans tried this before. Between 93 and 97, they pursued a policy that they called critical dialogue, which was intended to open up Iran and modulate its behavior, lessen its support of terrorism in exchange for economic benefits, financial incentives, diplomatic normalization. That backfired gloriously. By the time the Europeans cut off those contacts in 97, Iran was in a much better place financially than it was in 93. And it did nothing to modulate the type of rhetoric and the type of activity that were coming out of Tehran. So the current initiative to offer economic inducements and diplomatic offsets in exchange for a nuclear freeze smacks an awful lot of critical dialogue. And it seems to me that fool us once, shame on you, fool us twice. Anyway. We all know that Monday is shaping up to be a make or break day. On Monday, the International Atomic Energy Agency Board of Governors meets to consider the Iranian nuclear file, as they call it. And there is a hope, at least in some quarters, that they are going to refer the nuclear file to the Security Council. They're going to find Iran in noncompliance of monitoring obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and say the Security Council needs to take up the issue. The problem is the Security Council I would wager money, a little bit, not a lot, but I would wager money that the Security Council is not. Because two of the permanent members of the Security Council, Russia and China, are two of the principal providers of Iranian nuclear know-how and technology over the last 20 years. I tend to think, by the way, I have a somewhat agnostic approach to Russia. I think the Russians could be courted to actually cooperate with us on this for a number of domestic realities. There are predictions coming out of Moscow now that by the middle of next year, 20 million ethnic Russians in the south of Russia, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, will actually be within ballistic missile reach of Iran. So, I mean, I think the Russians are waking up slowly to the fact that this sort of proliferation is not a cost-free venture, that they actually will have to pay the piper at some point. And, by the way, the Russians take the chairmanship of the G8 at the end of the year. And so it would behoove them to actually have a forward-leaning stance on issues that could be as divisive as the Iranian nuclear issue could be. China, though, I think is a very different matter entirely. The Chinese, over the last 9 months or so, have succeeded in signing at least two 25-year energy development and exploration deals with Iran, worth a cumulative, the estimates vary, but it's somewhere between $70 billion and $100 billion over 25 years. This suggests that the Chinese have basically offered a Security Council veto to the Iranians, de facto. Because China, as we know, is rapidly rising economically, and it needs external energy sources and more of them to supply the sort of economic growth that you're looking at. It's very unlikely to take Iran off the table as a potential energy partner. And as we go forward, as those fields mature, as the type of development begins to reap dividends, concrete dividends for the Chinese economy, they're going to become less and less likely to cooperate, not more. So this gets us to what we should do. And here, let me emphasize, this is not an orthodoxy of thought that I'm preaching. The second half of my book is a lot about options that are on the table for us, because there are a lot of tools that we're not using at the moment that I tend to think would be useful to use. First of all, the fundamental problem is that the nuclear clock, the clock ticking down until the time that Iran has a nuclear bomb, is ticking very fast and very loudly. The regime change clock, and by this I mean the clock ticking down to the time where there is a transformation of the regime, and I tend to think that's going to happen internally, not from external force. But until there's a substantial transformation of the government in Iran, it's ticking much slower. So, and as soon as Iran gets a bomb, the biggest casualty is going to be Iranian democracy itself. Iran will be able to repress its domestic opposition with impunity the way China did in Tiananmen Square in 1989. So I think the stakes are very high here. And the fundamental starting point for any serious strategy, in my opinion, has to be, how do you make the nuclear clock tick slower and the regime change clock tick faster? So let me offer some ideas by way of the first and then the second. I think you can actually delay and blunt Iranian nuclear ambitions in at least three ways. I mean, I'm sure there's more, but let me just focus on three ways. First of all, right now, the type of shift that you're seeing in the Persian Gulf is entirely a result of the fact that the U.S. strategic umbrella in the Persian Gulf especially, is eroding. And it's eroding in a very unconstructive fashion. You're seeing the smaller countries of the Gulf begin to make security pacts with their larger, more menacing, almost nuclear neighbor. And you want to prevent that from happening. You want to head off the idea of a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. And you want to prevent the Middle East from becoming much less hospitable to U.S. forces, to coalition forces. So you can do that by injecting some doubt into Iranian calculus about what they can expect from their neighbors. For example, accelerated deployment of defenses, and I'm thinking here in terms of theater missile defenses, defenses that are capable of protecting countries like Oman or Saudi Arabia or Kuwait from Iranian ballistic missiles, because after all, the nukes don't matter unless they can deliver them, would go a long way towards injecting some doubt into the calculus of policymakers in Tehran. Right now, they know that with a credible ballistic missile and nuclear blackmail threat, they can pretty much dictate terms to their neighbors in the Persian Gulf. The Gulf Cooperation Council, when it gets together annually, for the last 3 or 4 years running, has routinely cited the missile threat from the eastern part of the Gulf as one of their main concerns. Now, I don't have a map in behind me, but I think I can tell you where that is. They're worried about Iranian capabilities, and fairly substantial. So providing these countries with defenses and reinforcing our alliances with them in a way that blunts Iranian influence over them will go a long way towards containing the type of regional reach that Iran is trying to build in the Persian Gulf at the moment. And by the way, there's a potential actually to be really productive and think outside the box on these sort of issues. Right now, the United States, working through NATO in tandem with the Russians, is helping to build up the Navy of Kazakhstan, the Republic of Kazakhstan, which is a Caspian littoral state. The purpose of that is intended to be to provide protection for offshore oil resources, things like that. But I think it's useful to think about it from a different perspective. Ballistic missiles launched from territorial Iran towards Europe, 90% of them pass over the Caspian and Black Seas geographically. So having defenses based in those bodies of water that are capable of neutralizing the nuclear blackmail threat that Iran poses to our allies in Eastern Europe and eventually to Central Europe as well, and even old Europe, would, I think, be very constructive, and it would actually be something that I think the Russians would be very keen to do, because the Russians have been trying to establish themselves very much as a guarantor of Europe's economic fortunes, Europe's energy future, and possibly Europe's security future as well. The other front I would talk about is counterproliferation. The most important thing that this administration has done has gotten practically no press. It's something called the Proliferation Security Initiative. PSI, for short. It is not an international organization. It's a series of bilateral arrangements between, at last count, more than 60 countries that creates expedited, and we're in a law firm, so create expedited arrangements that allow for mutual alteration of international law to permit hot pursuit into territorial waters, to permit interdiction, intelligence sharing on situations where weapons of mass destruction are implicated. And in fact, the proof is in the pudding. PSI has managed to curtail as much as 2/3 of North Korean WMDA missile trade over the last 2.5 years, 2 years. So I think it's very successful. The problem is PSI so far is a one-trick pony. PSI only has been applied really to North Korea, and frankly, that's for practical purposes. Geographically, North Korea is much easier to contain because of all that water than Iran is. But I think policymakers should think seriously about internationalizing the PSI model and bringing it to the Eastern Med, bringing it to the Caspian, bringing it to the Persian Gulf, for a number of reasons, not least among them the fact that one of the major suppliers for the Iranian nuclear program, the nuclear cartel of AQ Khan, is still in business. That Pakistani cartel provided Iran with a lot of nuclear blueprints and technological know-how over the last 15 years. And there's a lot of signs that at least segments of that network are still active, and they tend to base themselves out of places like Dubai and the United Arab Emirates. So, point being, there's a lot of proliferation traffic, both conventional and unconventional, going on in the Persian Gulf. And it really would behoove us to have a forward-thinking mechanism that could alleviate some of that pressure. The second thing is, Iran has become a secondary proliferant. More and more you're seeing signs that Iran is passing along technology acquired from Russia, from China, from North Korea, to groups like Hezbollah in Lebanon, to the Libyan government, to the Syrian government. So you have the two dynamics here. You have technology that's flowing to Iran, which you need to contain, and you have technology flowing out of Iran that you need to contain as well. And cobbling together a mechanism that can do both would really, I think, serve as well. And the last one is a larger sort of strategic point. Our alliance system in the Persian Gulf has eroded considerably over the last decade. And in the absence of credible American security assurances, the countries in that region have been forced to make other plans, and they're tending lately to be making them with Iran. So if the U.S. needs to think about a new sort of regional arrangement in which there are security guarantees provided from the United States to countries that are there that otherwise would be forced to partner with Iran, that might go a long way towards lessening Iranian influence over those countries. So I throw those out to you just simply as you know, ideas to think about. But those ideas and others, that's just the starting point, I think. And I think that's the point to emphasize. Those things can create a window of opportunity. And it's clear that they can, actually. The Israelis used to talk a lot about the point of no return, as they called it, for the Iranian nuclear program, rolling around sometime in late 2004. Now they talk about early 2007. So it's quite clear that you can delay Iranian nuclear ambitions. And what's not clear at all is whether or not you can change the end point of Iran's nuclear drive. Iran wants the bomb. So you can flex their timeline, but what you do in the time that you have bought yourself is crucially important. I think probably even more important than the foregoing proposals I suggested. And here we talk, let me talk for a minute about the internal situation. We've seen over the last 4 months a fairly disheartening series of circumstances. You saw the election of a conservative president in Iran. You saw his selection of even more conservative hardliners to serve in his cabinet. You now see an Iranian presidency in lockstep with the clerical leadership over the direction of the country, newer emphasis on strategic developments like the nuclear program, the ballistic missile program. I would say, though, that all of that is true, but that's something of a facade, because there are empirical, sociological, and economic factors that you can obtain by going on Iranian government ministry sites, and our government ministry sites that tend to track these things, that suggest that the regime is far less consolidated internally than it appears on the outside. Give you an example. Per capita GDP in Iran currently is at pre-revolutionary levels. 1977, I think, is the number they use, which suggests that all of the Islamic Revolution, all of the Islamic Republic, is awash in economic terms. Iranians are worse off now than they were in 1977, or at least as bad off. They have actually not netted anything from the 26 years of the Islamic Republic. And by the way, that goes a lot towards explaining why Iranians tend to be somewhat discontented with the government. They fret constantly about cronyism and corruption and nepotism in their government, about the fact that resources are allocated in a statist fashion. They're not actually enriching the people. They're not creating a middle class. That's something we can work on. Half the population, according to official estimates, lives under the poverty line. The poverty line, not our poverty line, the poverty line established by the Iranian government. And that's a huge development. Unemployment in Iran is at 20 to 25% and rising. And drug addiction rates in Iran, which only has 70 million people as compared to the U.S., is 5 times higher than that of the United States. So this tends to paint a picture of something that looked an awful lot like Eastern Europe at the end of the Cold War. We had this sort of rampant malaise that would slacken the ideological bonds that hold the people to the regime. The question is, how do you harness them? And in my book, I talk a fair amount about using public diplomacy as not as what we're using it now, which is to pump pop music into the Iranian airwaves, but as a tool of political warfare. The fact that there are plenty of opposition groups that we need to think about talking about, we need to take a good look at various opposition groups and their claims to have popularity within Iran in a way we haven't done before. There are journalists that we can empower to send to report on domestic situations and human rights violations in a way that we, you know, we used to do in the Soviet Union. We don't do when the Soviet Union was around. We don't do anymore in the sort of the Jackson Vanek type of fashion. There are a series of things we can do, but the real fundamental thing that the U.S. government has to do, and it has to do something soon, is to figure out whether it wants behavioral modification or regime change. And this is the fundamental question. I don't think I can emphasize this enough. So far, the administration really hasn't articulated it in any sort of coherent fashion. It's one thing for the president to issue a Friday afternoon communique saying, we support Iran's urge for democracy. It's another thing entirely to prove it. I think we're not proving it. I'll give you an example. The broadcasting budget that they disclosed publicly from the Broadcasting Board of Governors for all federal programming towards Iran, that includes radio and television and satellite and internet, currently stands at $16.4 million. Iran is a nation of 70 million people. That means that, now I'm not a mathematician, but, you know, I can do a little bit of simple division. That's about 21 and a half cents per Iranian per year that we're spending on outreach. Now, you could argue about how much more that should be increased, but quite clearly that's not sufficient. You know, and we can quibble along, you know, partisan lines about, you know, we should add 10 million more or 100 million more. But it's quite clear that the method is not going through. And I'll explain why. During the Soviet era, our radios, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, were probably the most successful way that we did outreach to the Soviets. Right now, the type of money we're spending on Iran is less than one-third of what we were spending per Soviet in 1983. So we've taken a step backward. But the biggest step backward that I think we've taken is we don't really have a clarity of message. You can funnel all the money that you want into these tools to empower the Iranian opposition, but the Iranian opposition needs to know that we're behind them. And, you know, this is, I think, the fundamental question. The administration has waxed very profoundly about the fact that, it wants Iranian democracy, but it hasn't actually told the Iranians that it will be with them in the long haul. And it has to do that, and it has to do that very soon. Because 5 years from now, 10 years from now, depending on who you believe, there will be a nuclear Iran. And whether or not that Iran is governed by an unaccountable set of people who find themselves to be at war with the United States and the West really depends a lot on the choices that we make now. So I think I'll stop there, and I'm sure you guys all have questions. Oh, thanks. Sorry.
Thank you for your thoughtful strategic analysis. I'd like to ask what is probably a very naive question, but please forgive me. It's about 35 years since you said Kissinger first secretly and then for overt way made an opening to what was then viewed as our number one bugaboo with China. And although it's far from perfect, there were 35 years of some accommodation. Is anyone, do you write in your book or do you know of anyone, is there any hope whatsoever here in a non-public or other way to approach the regime other than to label them and outlaw them and see if there's any way that we could move away from what looks like the onset of confrontation?
My answer would, let me hedge a little bit and say maybe, but I frankly think that the chances are slim to none for the simple reason that that type of detente that we had with the Chinese has only been sustainable over the long term, and I think we're seeing ripples in that relationship now, as a matter of fact. But it's been sustainable over the long term because China's had to face fundamental market facts. It's liberalizing its economy. The first time over the last 5-7 years, China's begun to develop a middle class. And that middle class means that, you know, that has some sort of modulating effect. That's why, by the way, a lot of people that work on Iran talk about, oh, can we do the China model in Iran? Can we sort of wait for this sort of internal economic liberalization? But, as I said, per capita GDP in Iran is at 1977 levels. That suggests that the affairs of state, economic affairs of state, are still being conducted in a statist, corrupt, and nepotistic fashion. So waiting around for that internal generation of a middle class that will sort of modulate the foreign policy is going to be a much more graded process than the type of advances we're seeing them take. There's a lot of argument that says that, you know, we could take these mincing steps towards, you know, establish, you know, through third parties, establish dialogue, all that stuff. I think that will work. I think, you know, the European track, as I said, you know, has been good for tactical purposes. But over the long term, this is a regime that has pretty much made its intentions known, if we care to listen. They've declared war on us, we just haven't noticed. And changing that is going to take more than a little bit of time. And changing those attitudes is going to take more than a little bit of time. There's a great piece that's circulating on the internet now, which I read on the train ride on the way up, about how the Iranian clerical army, the Pasdaran, actually is looking at the Hurricane Katrina disaster as the weakness of the United States. And how, you know, oh, we can exploit this. We realize that America has no domestic emergency preparedness. Yeah, I wonder what we could do. That's somewhat unsettling to me. And it suggests that that type of thinking still tends to predominate. And unfortunately, that type of thinking, certainly since last summer, since this past summer, has tended to occupy all of the levers of power, even the ones that are ostensibly accountable, like the president's.
You told us about the economic interests that China and Russia have in supporting relationship with Iran. Are either of those countries at all concerned about the possibility of the radicalization of their Muslim population by Iran? And number two, you also mentioned something about the second question, you mentioned something about power supporting the opposition in Iran. Do we not have to be careful about painting the opposition?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Well, let me answer the first. Russia has always cooperated with Iran on the idea that it holds the whip hand in that relationship, that it's the stronger partner. I am far from convinced that Russia is actually the stronger partner. I can envision a situation in which Russia, for all sorts of practical reasons, decides that it wants denuclearized Iran, or it wants Iran to be referred to the Security Council and to curb Iran's nuclear ambitions. And at that point, I suspect someone in the Kremlin is going to get a phone call from Tehran that says, well, that's great, but you can no longer count on our good behavior in places like Chechnya. And that exposes a huge vulnerability. Russia, President Putin in Russia, came to power arguing a very hard anti-terrorist line. His counterterrorism policy, the secret is, has been somewhat of a disaster. And they have a huge vulnerability. So I suspect that you could move the Russians, but it's not cost-free. And the Chinese have very much less influence in that fashion, in the sense that the Chinese are not yet within Iranian ballistic missile range. They don't feel threatened by the type of radical Islam yet to any sort of fashion that Iran could export. So, again, I think Russia's a wild card. I think China is pretty much, the hand has been dealt. On the opposition, I think you're right. And obviously, regime change post-Iraq is a very hard sell, because as soon as I say the words regime change, I see some people say, oh, wait a second, are you advocating military action? Let me be clear. Military action is not on the table here. It's not on the table except possibly, maybe as a last resort, either by us or by the Israelis. That's a different discussion entirely. But the point here is that we need to be smart about who we see as the people to engage in Iran. For a long time in Washington, Washington was paralyzed because there were two camps within the government basically fighting it out. There's one camp that said, oh, there's a reformist president at that point, Mohammad Khatami, and he's trying to push incremental reform within the legislature, within the Majlis. We should back him and sort of not do anything to upset the apple cart, and over time they'll liberalize. Now, 8 years later, we've realized that's not the case. And it turns out that the other group, which said, you know what, the real glimmers of Iranian democracy, of an accountable Iranian government that we can do business with, they're actually found on the Iranian street. Excuse me. Those guys turned out to be right. So, unfortunately, though, that dispute within the U.S. government, within the policymaking community, hasn't really progressed beyond that who should we engage type of discussion until very recently. So we're very newborn in our discussions of what the opposition groups are. Who are they? Are they popular even within Iran? There's a lot of people that come around Capitol Hill, for example, near where I work, that do a lot of lobbying for their organization of choice. In D.C., the joke goes that there's really only two choices for Iranian opposition groups. There's the monarchists, like the Young Shah, and there's the Marxists, like the Mujahideen account, which is, by the way, a foreign terrorist organization, according to the State Department. Even those guys, I would say, haven't been vetted properly. I'll give you an example. The Young Shah spends a lot of time talking about that he supports a referendum and that he would like that the ideas that he's espousing, he doesn't want to return to the monarchy, but the ideas he's espousing in a pluralistic sort of feedback survey from the Iranian people are very popular. I would expect that they are, but we don't know, because we've actually never conducted grassroots polling in Iran to find out if he's popular as a leader. So, we run the risk of actually backing a very unpopular horse, because we don't know. The MEK is a different situation entirely. Since 1997, they've been a foreign terrorist organization, according to the State Department. But since the middle of 2003, they've also been they've also had the classification of protected persons under the Geneva Conventions, as given by CENTCOM. So, I'm a lawyer, although most of you guys are as well, I would expect. A terrorist organization, or a terrorist entity, is de facto an unprivileged combatant under the law of war. That's the way the Geneva Conventions are written. A protected person is a mostly civilian classification of a protected class. You can't be both. And right now, the MEK are both. And you know how the State Department resolves that dichotomy is going to be really important. If they delist them, then, well, maybe they're an option. It's certainly something that the regime is looking at very closely and watching what we do. But my point in all of this is a discussion that is very newborn, it's very infantile in its early stages, and it's something that we should have been doing a long time ago, but we really need to do it now.
Michael Levine makes a very strong case for destabilizing the regime through reaching out through some of the programs. Can you comment a little bit more about the present program that the United States is engaging in, the ROC, the popular programs, how that's working, how much money, and where does Levine stand, where is his status, so to speak, in having this idea advanced?
Let me say this. I certainly can't speak for him. I saw him last week, so I might be able to tell you at least what he was thinking then. I mean, I'll contain myself to that. But he and I had a sit-down because he read my book and he had some ideas. And he was making that point, the point that Iran is actually much less consolidated, but in a different fashion than I described. It's much less consolidated because it's a sort of potpourri of different ethnic groups that are all coexisting and sometimes very aggressively, you know, with one another, but they're sort of coexisting in Iran. There are more ethnic Azeris in Iran than there are in the entire Republic of Azerbaijan, the country. So, you know, it's quite clear that there are tools to work with here if we want to think outside the box. Michael, I know, is a big advocate of empowering those opposition groups, those ethnically based opposition groups, as an alternative. I think that is, you know, a superb way to go. I frankly think that the more outside of the box thinking that we can do on this, you know, where are the points of weakness of the regime, the better. And I think Michael, you know, might quibble with me about some of the details, but I think the end point that I got to, you know, where the administration really needs to decide, you know, is this a regime we can do business with, or do we need to seek somebody else, has to be the fundamental first step. I think that's a great question because, frankly, that's the only question, and I'll explain why. About 3 weeks ago, there was the new National Intelligence Estimate, which is put out by the NIC, the National Intelligence Council, which is sort of the governing body of all the intelligence agencies, the sort of the presiding body that does the agency-wide, industry-wide analysis, leaked a report to the Washington Post, which talked about the fact that now the intelligence community, they used to be rather coy about when a nuclear one would materialize, they used to say somewhat later in the decade. Now they're actually pushing back that estimate and saying 2015 is what they think. Frankly, that's foolish. And it's foolish for a number of reasons. First of all, as I said, the AQCON network is still active, and we don't know what they're doing. So we have no idea whether the Iranians are still communicating with them. Second of all, the Iranians have been busy on the nuclear black market in the former Soviet Union since at least 1994 that we know about. The CIA has testified publicly to Congress that it has been unable to satisfactorily track Iranian acquisition on the nuclear black market in Eastern Europe and the post-Soviet space. So there's a lot of what Don Rumsfeld calls unknown unknowns. And it would be foolish to push the timeline back. At the very least, let's keep it at the same place. But this, I think the whole intelligence estimate is somewhat besides the point. Because the timeline that we really need to be worried about, if we sort of, you know, take my assumption that preemption is probably not a great idea, military force is probably not a great idea because it has all sorts of bad things that flow from it. The real timeline that we need to be worried about is not ours. It's that of the most skittish member of our coalition in this endeavor. And that happens to be the Israelis. And the Israelis think that nuclear capabilities and materials much, much sooner than we do. They've actually revised their estimates back a little bit. They think now a nuclear Iran will be a reality in early 08 or late 07, early 08. It depends. I mean, and they have a, you know, a cacophony of voices within their government as well. Military intelligence thinks one thing, Mossad thinks something else. But the point is, it's this decade. It's not next decade. It's this decade. And if the Israelis understand that we are basing our projections on something that is concocted by the CIA that puts the threat very far out, they're liable to do something about it because they're going to figure that we're not going to do it. And I would argue, you know, I made the point in passing that I tend to think that preemption is should be viewed only as a last resort. I'll explain why. In Iran, there are, you know, the preponderance of people are against the regime. But either you're with the regime or against the regime, you might still want nuclear weapons because there's a lot of historical and cultural factors that flow into that. Iran is not a 20th century invention like most of the other states around it. It has a deep historical and cultural heritage. It was an empire at one point. And, you know, there are elements of prestige here. Iran is also in a really dangerous neighborhood. When the Pakistanis did their first above-ground nuclear test in 98, they did it 30 kilometers outside of the Iranian border. They didn't do it near India. So when the Iranians talk about the fact that they live in a nuclearized neighborhood, you know, I give them a little bit of leeway. I tend to see what they're coming from. You know, Russia has nukes, India has nukes, Pakistan has nukes, Israel has nukes, although we don't talk about it. And, you know, this is a problem. Well, we don't talk about it. They presumably have nukes. So the point is, you know, if they're talking about it from a national security standpoint, I mean, I could see that argument. And by the way, there's lots of apologists who say, oh, a nuclear Iran, they'll be a mature nuclear possessor. I don't think so. And I don't think so precisely for the reason I mentioned. It's a question of regime character. The administration doesn't oppose a nuclear Iran, by the way. The administration, it would be okay with a civilian nuclear program in a post-theocratic, reasonably accountable, Western-leaning, market-oriented government in Iran. Because, after all, that's France, right? One would think. Now, we may not like the French, but we're not going to go to war with them, and we're not going to preempt their nuclear program. So the question ends up being, can these guys be trusted with nuclear weapons? And the Israelis don't think they can. And frankly, the administration doesn't think they can. And so it ends up opening up the whole discussion about preemption. Now, it's not a good idea, but for lack of better ones, it might just become more feasible.
Okay. Earlier, you mentioned you didn't believe in Iraq weapons of mass destruction.
Let me hedge here. By the way, you know, sir, for full restoration purposes, I supported the war in Iraq. I certainly back the president. I tend to back the president in sort of taking him at his word, which is Iraq is a crucial front in the war on terror, which, by the way, implicitly presupposes there's going to be others. But anyway, what I said actually was that we've not found anything, or has not, does not seem to have, I think, I hope I said that, does not seem to have any, much by way, if at all, by way of weapons of mass destruction capabilities. I think there's a lot of, again, unknown unknowns when it comes to the Iraqi program. I think it was yesterday when the Iraqi Prime Minister was in town. He talked about the fact that we all know, you know, we ethnic groups within Iraq know that he had weapons of mass destruction because he used them on us. So, you know, there's quite a bit of disagreement still there. The point is, though, that if you are articulating a strategic conflict as important as preemption, because frankly that's what we're talking about, you have to meet a minimum threshold of risk. The real nexus the president was talking about was the confluence of a regime that sponsors terrorism and the presence of weapons of mass destruction. The fact that we haven't found WMD, irrespective of whether or not they're there or they're in Syria or wherever it is, undercuts the case for preemption in later circumstances. Unfortunately. I think it's very bad because particularly, you know, I think Iran is a prime candidate for this sort of discussion. Sir? That's a very real possibility, certainly. And one of the things that I would say is we Americans are remarkable for our ability to win a conflict and then promptly forget all of the lessons about how we won that conflict. One of the most useful tools in internationalizing the debate over Soviet repression was the Helsinki Final Act, which actually was the basis that Scoop Jackson and his cohorts used to create predicate most favored nation status on release of Jews from the Soviet Union, and more illustration on what it was doing internally. When that happened, and you shone an international spotlight on the internal situations, the regime will de facto have much less maneuver room. Right now, the Iranians pretty much, there's this journalist, I'm sure you've heard of him, by the name of Akbar Ganji. Most people have heard of the name, but they don't know who he is. He's a journalist. He's been on a hunger strike off and on for the last, 5 months. Because he's protesting the treatment of his colleagues, repression, lack of media freedoms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The international community has been notoriously ignorant of his plight. When you begin to pick up the idea of Akbar Ganji, or others, I mean, there's plenty of others. Ahmed Batebi was the guy on the Economist cover that you guys all remember with the bloody shirt after the 1999 protests at Tehran University. He is the most hunted man in Iran. He is, goes from safe house to safe house. When the international community begins to pay attention to the plight of those kinds of people, the regime will, and actually censure the regime in international fora for acting against them, the regime will find that it's the type of activities that it's engaging in now, both domestically and internationally, have a much higher price tag attached to them.
Describe how complicated the factors are making President Bush internationally on how he must decide how to proceed. Let me ask you to make it more complicated. To what extent
sure.
do domestic factors in our own political situation provide additional obstacles to further constrain what choices our administration has?
That's a little more complicated. Not much, though. No, I think that is key, because after all politics is ultimately local. You know, if Vladimir Putin decides to work with us on Iran, it's not going to be because of some enlightened self-interest. It's going to be because he feels politically unstable at home as a result. So I think it's a great question. Let me answer with a little story. When I was finishing my book, it was right after the re-election, early December, and I rang one of my friends who happens to work in the West Wing, and they have this, all of you know what Google is, right? It's the internet search engine. They have, in the West Wing, in the executive branch, they have an internal Google service where you can actually find who has responsibility for which portfolio, because they don't all know each other. They need to figure out, you know, if they're working a cross-cutting issue, they need to be able to figure out who it is. And for kicks, I egged my friend on to doing a Google search for who has partial responsibility for the Iran portfolio, whether it's proliferation or economic issues or diplomacy or whatever, what have you. And he said, you know, he finally acquiesced to do it, and I heard him typing, and there was this long silence at the end of the line. And he says, "Well, you're really not going to like this." And I said, "Well, I'm sure I'm not, but why don't you tell me?" And he said, "Oh, right now, you know, this snapshot in time, there's about 4 or 5 jobs that are vacant relating to Iran." So the point of this is, if it looks like we don't have a policy, it might be because of personnel. After all, you can't have an interagency if you have nobody manning the desks. So I think it's better now. I actually know some of the people that have been brought in to fill those slots. But I would suggest that we are far from having a mature internal discussion to consolidate the Iran policy. And in the absence of an Iran policy, we've gotten into this bad habit of subcontracting. Since February, we've been subcontracting to the European Union on these nuclear negotiations, right? Because they're trying something, we don't have any good ideas, so we might as well go along with them. The problem is, this is a time-consuming process. To verify Iranian bad faith and noncompliance. In the interim, Iran gets valuable time to work on clandestine enrichment, to expand its strategic horizons. And, okay, so now that I've painted a very glass half empty picture, let me add one thing. All of this, everything I've talked about in the first part of my talk, is going to get much, much worse, and soon. Iran's federal budget that we know about for 2004-2005 is $127 billion. Half of that comes from oil revenues. They're a major exporter, 3.9 million barrels a day. But half of the budget is pegged to oil, and the price of oil at $19.90 a barrel. So what's the price of oil now? It's last time I checked, it was the low 60s, right? Something like that. So one only hopes that the excess billions that they reap, or dozens of billions that they reap every year, that prices are high, are going to be used for constructive purposes. But I suspect what you're going to see is you're going to see an upsurge in the capabilities that they can marshal, because you're going to find more available cash for strategic programs, more available cash for funding the insurgency in Iraq, for example, because after all, it's fairly cheap in comparative terms. So this is all going to get worse. And this is, by the way, a larger structural problem that we're really not dealing with in the war on terror. What goes for Iran goes in spades for Saudi Arabia. The Saudi budget is much bigger, and it's 70% pegged to the price of oil at $17 a barrel. So the Saudis are getting stronger, too. So, I mean, this is just another aspect. But, yes, it's a very complicated situation. And, again, you know, when I talk about a window of opportunity, there's that economic dimension of it as well. At a certain point, the regime will be so consolidated and so flush with cash that they can pay off, bribe people in a way that will mute the domestic discord that you're seeing now. Because, after all, they can just hire more mercenaries. In Iran, yeah.
About domestic discord in the U.S. Iran, I think we're going to have to cut off the discussion.
Don't
Or at least the public discussion.
Sure.
Sure. I think you're around for a few minutes.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm
welcome
to answer questions that anybody they still have. I'm sure there's a good number of them. So thank you very much for this question.
Oh, okay.